Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to, in about 15 minutes, try to cover a very big set of topics, so it'll be pretty much an overview, but I hope I can bring some food for thought to this discussion. What I'm going to do in my talk is just briefly look at what these most recent trends in global food and energy prices have been. Then I'll talk about what the contributing factors are to food security and food scarcity and price rises, just touching a bit on what happened the last 7 or 8 years, but really looking going from there to a forward-looking assessment. Then I'll do a sort of a broad overview of some policy recommendations for how can we get pro-poor growth in agriculture that is not damaging to the environment and water in particular. I think all of you are familiar now with this with graphs that look like this in terms of trends from 2000 to early this year on energy prices and key commodities, including wheat, rice, and maize. As you can all see, we saw some steady increases in commodity prices up through about May 2006 and into 2007, and then you saw huge spikes running up into 2008, early 2008. Then you've seen quite a dramatic fall since about May 2008. But one thing I'd like to point out is that aside from the oil price, which is in the red, the other commodity prices have indeed not fallen to the extent as oil. They've been stronger, and their futures prices now indicate we're expecting stronger prices over the coming year for a number of factors, and I'll go into those a bit now. I think we all know at least parts of the story about this past several years. One of the factors involved certainly was biofuels, and particularly the corn ethanol policies in the United States and biodiesel policies also in Europe. The sugarcane policies, as John Briscoe's already pointed out, had very little to do with food price increases. You can get estimates all over the place for what contribution of biofuels was to that. Our estimates at IFPRI say it's about 30% of the increase in cereal or grain prices was due to biofuels, with a heavier percentage on maize or corn, as would be expected. But I think even more important than the biofuels have been the changing fundamentals that underlie agricultural growth and food security. I think everyone is familiar with the rapid income growth in much of Asia, particularly in India and China. But what hasn't been noticed quite as much is that Africa has had a relative boom also since the late 1990s, with overall growth in sub-Saharan Africa of over 5% in annual GDP. And these countries, in particular in Africa, have a high propensity to consume food out of increased income, and were a significant boost to the growth in demand for food staples such as rice, corn, and wheat. Very important and perhaps most fundamental was the underinvestment in agricultural productivity and technology growth. And again, John has already talked about that and shown the significant declines in investment in agriculture over a 20 to 30-year period, which has caused significant slowdowns in productivity growth in terms of output per unit of land or water. Water and land scarcity, and particularly in this past several years, water scarcity in terms of production shocks due to droughts in Australia, the Ukraine, and others also played an important part. And what I'm going to say these factors are going to be much more important in the future, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment in the context of climate change. Energy prices also drove high input and transport costs, which further hit the ag sector. And then in that huge run-up where you did get a bubble effect in early 2008, there were a number of impacts from bad trade policies where countries put export bans like Vietnam on rice and erected high tariff barriers to protect their own consumers while exporting high prices to other countries. That also helped trigger even lower stocks and greater speculation. And there also exchange rate movements had something to do with it as well. But what happens then in the longer run? If we look in the long term, a world with higher energy prices than we have historically have. As you see, prices are already back up again to, what, $50 per barrel currently after the slide down in 2008. A number of things are going to happen. One is I think we are going to have increased demand for biofuels again. That's not just a temporary phenomenon. We will have new technologies out there eventually, but right now there's nothing on the immediate horizon to replace the current generation of ethanol. The cellulosics and so forth may come in 5 years, but that's also what they were saying 5 years ago. Higher energy costs, I think very importantly, are going to increase the cost of water pumping and conveyance and also of desalinization. And that, together with the higher value of water because of both higher food prices and these higher costs of generating water, are going to put much more pressure on needing efficient allocation and likely including water markets or other kinds of economic allocation methods, and on conservation so that technologies and investments in new technologies for water management are going to be necessary. Overall, higher energy prices are going to make water and power subsidies too costly. And if there's a silver lining over the long-term change in relative underlying factor prices in agriculture, it is that bad policies are just going to become too costly to do. I think if India attempts to continue the same water and power subsidies that they have for agriculture now, I think they really are going to break their national and state budgets. It just costs too much at the higher prices. High energy prices also have effects on land, and this goes on both crops and livestock. In the livestock area, you're going to get higher feed prices as food prices go up and as the energy cost of intensive livestock production goes up. So you're going to expect livestock prices to go up with some impacts on consumption, but also with pressure to move towards extensive conversion of additional pasture land to production of livestock, perhaps to substitute for loss of production in the more intensive systems that become more expensive. So again, because of energy prices and higher food prices, there's going to be much greater pressure on the land base. In addition, you've seen already in the United States and in other parts of the world that increased demand for land will lead to less conservation and expansion of the agricultural land base unless we have countervailing improvements in agricultural productivity growth. You've already seen the conservation program land being transferred into energy crops here in the U.S. with shifting to maize for biofuels. And I think some people are thinking, well, maybe this is a short-term phenomenon and we'll work our way out. But I do want to point out that there's likely to be very large demands for significant expansion of biofuels or land-based biomass for climate mitigation in the future. And this is just one sample. This happens to be from MIT's group that works on long-term climate change and integrative assessment issues. On the upper left-hand corner there, you see a reference scenario for the expansion of land area where there's no attempt to control greenhouse gas emissions. So it's sort of a very radical business as usual scenario. As you can see in there, that biomass, that sort of light green in the middle, doesn't come in to heavy production until about 2040 into any production until 2040 to 2050. But in what we hope is going to be a much more realistic scenario in the lower right-hand corner, where you put in policies in terms of carbon taxes and cap and trade policies to try to get a cumulative reduction of emissions by 40% from 2012 to 2100, which isn't that aggressive, to be honest. I mean, that's sort of a mid-level mitigation path. You can see that biomass now comes in much earlier and much bigger, and it particularly takes away forests from both pasture land, natural grass areas, which often have high biodiversity, and forest area. So the issue of biofuels and biomass is here to stay for the future. And this is just one example. If you look at any of the other major integrated assessment models, they have similar roles for biomass in the future. What's going to happen under climate change, which I think is probably going to be the game changer in the agriculture area? This is work done by Arnell, looking at changes in global annual runoff from now to about the mid-2050s. Here you see the reds and pink numbers are the highly negative ones, anywhere from 20 to 30% and greater reductions in runoff. You see that much of Africa, much of the productive areas in the United States, and in significant areas in Brazil, for example, are going to have very bad drop-offs and runoff. The other one to point out here is that India looks, hey, that looks pretty good. They're going to get 20 to 30% more runoff in general. But even that is misleading because the models now are showing that that additional runoff is going to be highly concentrated in short periods of time when it is not easily storable or catchable for agriculture. So much of that instead will be increasing floods in the wrong time of the year for crops. What happens in general with declining water in key areas and also a very rapid increase in industrial domestic use of water? This is from our own model, impact model, which is an integrated agriculture and water supply and demand model that does long-term projections. What we see is with fairly rapid growth in industrial and domestic, about nearly doubling between now and 2050, that irrigation, in fact, water is basically going to be about at the same levels now at best by 2050. So there's no more water that's going to be diverted under business usual scenario for irrigation. So you need to have very dramatic increases in water use efficiency and agricultural productivity to get the kinds of gains in production that you're going to need over time. This is a sort of simple way to summarize the effect of water scarcity. And again, this is under a climate change scenario. Water scarcity to grain production, and you can do similar exercises for other major commodities. Here we estimate an aggregate number for the world or for the developing countries of loss of grain production due to water scarcity. This is simply doing the long-term projections to compute the difference between what full water adequacy would be compared to the actual projected water adequacy over time. You can see currently in the 1990s we had a loss of about 100 million tons of grain per year. But we're projecting under this scenario over 450 million tons of losses annually, and this is rice, wheat, maize, and other grains every year in 2050. And that's equivalent to the current annual production of the United States and Canada. So basically, due to water scarcity, you're losing the entire production of the North American breadbasket every year by 2050. These are some new results we're doing at IFPRI. We're trying to look at a much more disaggregated look by crop and by subnational spatial units of the impact of climate change on maize yields. This is using the Hadley GCM and the so-called A2A scenario, which is sort of, about 2 years ago, this was considered quite a aggressive high temperature scenario. Now it's considered to be probably about a medium scenario given the most recent science. This shows for a maize variety that's reasonably well adapted to drought. It's not a super drought tolerant variety, but it shows, I think, the very dramatic challenge that's going to be facing us. And we have similar results that are just as dramatic for rice and wheat. The yellows and the reds there are losses anywhere from 5 to 25% of current levels of yields. And I draw your attention also to the brown color, which you can see particularly in the United States in parts of the southern Corn Belt and in much of Europe, but also through just the sub-Saharan countries in Africa and elsewhere. Those are areas where you will actually lose the ability to produce corn altogether because of changes in growing seasons. There is some compensation also but with new area in the north that's shown by green, but those areas have much lower productivity and probably less sustainability. So overall, we're projecting worldwide yields would decline by 17% due to climate change, and this includes temperature and water effects. What does that mean for food scarcity and food prices? Well, a quick measure of that is our prices. And this is the global price of maize under the baseline, which has climate change. So that's the blue line, and the red line shows what would happen without climate change. So the difference between those is the impact of climate change on global prices of maize as it works its way through the agriculture economy. As you can see, if you have the same weather as you had the past 30 years, the red line, you would get these increases in prices currently, but then they would start to tail off. With climate change, though, we get steady, long-term increases in the real price of agricultural commodities, and we find that for the other commodities as well. So just briefly then, to summarize, those are some of the key points are what the impacts are going to be of high energy prices and climate change. So what do we do to try to, in a sense, make it so those scenarios don't come true? I mean, the first step, and this is, I think, very consistent with what John was saying also, is really the need for massive increases in investment for increasing crop productivity per unit of land and per unit of water. That includes both straight agriculture research, crop breeding, water management, but also investment in rural infrastructure. In crop breeding, you're going to have to target much more aggressively the abiotic and biotic stresses. That includes drought tolerance, salinity tolerance, nitrogen use efficiency, and pest resistance as well, that are going to be particularly getting worse under climate change. And there is going to have to be much more use of GMOs and biotechnology. There's simply not enough natural variation genetically to deal with the new environments that we're going to be seeing. So, I do agree that it's distasteful for some, but I see no other solution than significant increases in the use of GMOs. The water area, one thing that does come on the table now is larger investments in larger dams for storage to reduce the variability, to increase storage where water is available is declining. But those investments need to be also complemented by more on-farm oriented management, including water harvesting, minimum tillage practices, integrated soil fertility management. Then on top of the investment in water infrastructure, we also need large investments additionally in roads, particularly in Africa, but also in parts of Asia and Latin America, to improve farmer access to markets, to risk insurance, and to credit and other inputs. I think one of the problems that still is bedeviling the whole issue of how do you get rapid growth under this new system of high energy prices and climate change is that policies are made in very uncoordinated fashion. And to go beyond that, we need to move to a full integration of policies that are aimed at agriculture growth, biofuels and energy, climate change, and carbon sequestration. So both as an institutional component, that the government agencies involved in these have to start talking to each other, so it's not the Ministry of Finance doing one thing, Ministry of Environment, Agriculture doing other things. But there's also a fundamental policy issue that in order to deal with these competing demands for land and water and the trade-offs with environment, we can only meet these if we start to bring seriously the externalities of the use of different inputs in different production systems into the growth equation. To do that, we need to establish economic incentives for water use based on water rights or water entitlements. So I was pleased to see Pakistan is actually moving seriously in that direction. But beyond water, we also need to look at markets for environmental services. There's various things have worked around the world, but there's a long way to go in terms of payment for environmental services for watershed management and biodiversity. We also, though, need to develop markets for agricultural and forest carbon to generate new value streams in rural areas through carbon mitigation. And many of the investments that would reduce carbon emissions are also exactly what's needed to improve productivity of land, such things as minimum tillage and other types of efficient water and land management at the local level. Thanks very much.